Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing a very important topic, the increasing jihadist attacks in the Alliance of Sahel States. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Cleonette Raleigh. Professor Raleigh is a professor of political geography and conflict at the University of Sources. She is also the president and founder of the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Cleonette, I'm very pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to a very exciting conversation with you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So let's start off. So in recent months, we've seen a proliferation of attacks in the Alliance, in the Sahel, basically, in the Alliance of Sahel States. I think it was last month, we saw the large-scale assaults in Bamako by the jihadists. And I think also in Burkina Faso, maybe last in August, we saw attacks on civilians and soldiers. So what is responsible for this spike in this attack?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the conflict in the Sahel has increased year on year, which is a very worrying trend, because when we started tracking it, of course, when it started over 10 years ago, it was already at quite a high level, and it's just continued. It's even continued quite a bit and has had quite a jump just in the last few years. In fact, there's a podcast tomorrow with Henny, who's our resident. Yeah, great. Well, he's going to do a podcast tomorrow about the geography of the IS attacks.
Okay.
And part of the reason why the recent increase is so obvious is that IS themselves have decided to expand their territorial footprint quite a bit. And that has been countered by groups like Wagner and others that have come in to try to mitigate the effects of IS. But this is happening, of course, while IS and JNIM are still actively contesting that territory. So that conflict, their conflict, JNIM and ISGS, is the central component of that larger conflict ecosystem. And so really how that conflict is going sets the tone for all of the other conflicts around it. And all have increased.
We've seen in the Lake Chad, because there's I'm currently editing a book volume looking at Boko Haram post 2015. So what we've seen is where you see competition between these groups, different groups, you also see collaboration. So you mentioned JNIM and IS. Is there any form of collaboration? It's just competition between these groups.
Oh, that's a good question. We did a paper a few years ago where we were talking about the types of competition between these groups in the Sahel. But what I always found interesting, and you'll know more than I about this, is why ISGS and ISWAP are not engaged more with each other, given that they hold such central positions. And I assumed that there was a level of ideological cooperation, but there is not any known, let's say, logistical cooperation or operational cooperation between the groups, although there's always rumors that these things are being developed and they're being trialed. I think that we should never forget that these groups are highly competitive inside each other, that, you know, they often fragment. And the fragmentation is due to, well, competing personalities, competing agendas, you know, differences of where they want to progress and what they want the strategies to be. So I think we should be very grateful that there isn't higher levels of cooperation, because they do have such a strong influence on the conflict environments in their respective countries that they're operating in.
One of the things you mentioned is the agendas, and over the years we've started seeing. My position would be, whereas these groups are like Islamic, whatever, but we've seen less Islamic ideological. I've read somewhere, was it ISGS or GNM, were reminded of their Islamic, whatever. It was more power and territory. Well, what can you say to that?
Well, I'm a firm believer that ideology is very much in the back seat for these groups. And as you say, sometimes they'll get a warning from an emir, or they'll get a warning from, let's say, you know, the central committees, that they are not acting in accordance with what they're presumed to be motivated by, which is, of course, jihad and very strong and absolute Islamic values. But I sometimes have a little bit of a controversial view on this, in which I believe that religious and often even ethnic, say, motivations for conflicts should be understood more as brands than as organizing principles, in the sense that a really great scholar named Katrina Dowd did some work on this, where she found that when Al-Qaeda was first coming into the African continent, it was looking for a new way to organize effectively new support, new recruits towards its ultimate drive. And it saw that the ethnic-based motivations were really saturated. You know, there were so many groups claiming to be representing communities that were distinguished by ethnic identity, that they needed a new brand in order to be able to get a lot of people. And Islam in that case, and eventually, of course, jihad, proved to be a really good organizing feature, in that you could cut across several ethnic groups. You could cut across income groups, you could cut across age groups, and your potential coalition could be far wider if you just chose a different brand through which you were. And then, you know, they operate, I would hesitate to say they operate differently, because they take on a jihadi mantle. I think that they are quite successful taking on a jihadi brand, because it seems to allow for enormous amounts of violence on all sorts of people, with some sort of permission to do it from within the group's ideology itself. But again, I think it's very instrumental, in the sense that it's used when it's useful and it's not used when it's not useful.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with that the religion of jihadists has been instrumentalized in this case. Well, we've seen a worrying trend where in the Sahel, where I think it was in Mali, where we've seen cooperation or coalition between the jihadists and the rebel groups against the government. How dangerous is this, and what's the scale of this? Is this one-off? Is this
Well, you're right in the sense that, you know, at different points in the conflict cycle, groups tend to ally together for a common enemy, and the common enemy can, of course, be the governments of these respective states. One of the things I have seen, which is a growing concern, is that governments will often arm communities. So they'll arm militias to contest these different armed groups. And then those groups get co-opted by those larger rebel, insurgent, jihadi groups, or whatever the case. And then you have new conflict cycles emerge from the fact that they all found it useful to cooperate. And it's important here to recognize that this really goes against our notion that they have ideological, let's say, strictures about how they operate, any group having that. All groups are trying to survive until the next day or trying to get a good payout for stopping violence. And so we shouldn't elevate it more than it is.
There's the mention Wagner Group. We've seen where traditional partners like, you know, the French and, you know, they've been booted out, and Russia Wagner was taken. But in recent times, you've also seen the Wagner Group or whatever BIB Group, whatever it's recently called, they've also suffered some casualties in this region. How does this impact on the situation on ground?
Yeah, I mean, Wagner, or as it's now known, I think Africa Corp, it had some early successes, as we know, and it was, I think of it very similar to executive outcomes. Do you remember executive outcomes?
From
early, I guess it was the early 1990s.
Yeah.
So these mercenary groups have often come in with a very clear objective and again, no guardrails about how they can act. So you can have some early successes, especially if you're not concerned about how many people you kill.
And
you're just given kind of carte blanche to operate as you see fit. But they're often, you know, they're often not particularly great soldiers. They are, especially in Wagner or Africa Corps context, they are being hired and paid through means that are not particularly clear, but can also be, they can be a low priority for their, for the people who put them together. And so the Africa Front, of course, for Russia was really designed in order to co-opt or to co-opt these countries for Russia's grander geopolitical ambitions. And Wagner was given as kind of a token for their problems. I guess I never think that these groups deliver like they're supposed to, in part because all conflicts are local, and understanding them requires a far higher degree of local knowledge and experience and strategy than these groups can ever muster.
Speaking of that externalization of this conflict, another worrying, and I don't think this is proven, but I think there's some level, I mean, in terms of like what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. So we've also seen where Ukraine might have supported some rebel group or, you know, jihadist group yeah, in Mali. Is that true? I don't know.
That kind of disinformation, I think, is really central to Russia, so that they say like, oh, don't look at us. You know, everybody else is doing it, but everybody else isn't doing it. So I wouldn't worry about that.
Yeah, I thought as much. I thought like, because we've had a podcast in when we looked at Sudan, where that came up as well, whether Russia is supporting, whether Ukraine is supporting either of the RP or the Sudanese armed forces. So looking at, but I'm wondering how Ukraine could have that level of clout.
Well, Ukraine has its own problems at the moment. They have, they constantly have weapons problems, so they can't actually support anybody else through any logistical means. They're having quite a lot of recruitment problems, and what they do have is really great reputations about how they're operating, and they're not going to destroy that by, I think, supporting groups in some other contexts.
To me as well, I've seen where, so if I look at the free alliance of these Sahel states, we've seen less. In relative sense, we've seen less attack in Niger compared to Mali and Burkina Faso. Why is that so?
Well, that's a good question. I think like it waxes and wanes. Sometimes Niger has quite a bit of activity. I think that In the beginning, it was presumed that Niger was more effective at contesting these groups. The Nigerian government was more effective at contesting. I think that we should always, I suppose, recall the ease at which it is to operate in an environment. I mean, an armed group is not going to choose to operate in a difficult environment. They're going to choose the easiest way in or the easiest way to destabilize. So I do want to emphasize, though, that there is quite a lot of ISGS activity within Niger, especially around the border region. But in terms of the density of attacks within that country, it is lower than the density within Mali and Burkina Faso, especially Burkina Faso at this point, and that overlap triangle. And while I think that if ISGS had an objective in Niger that they wanted to pursue, they could do so. I just think that the crux of that competition at the moment is always, you know, in the triangle. And so that's where they are continuously focused.
You mentioned ISGS, and I know these are the ISGS and then JNIM, and I know these are the major ones. What are the groups that are kind of like operating in these places?
That's a good point. I mean, there are, of course, a tremendous number of different militias that are operating, often community militias that when they organize outside their communities into some sort of like alliance structure, they become more serious contenders. But there are very few other, let's say, organized groups outside, of course, of northern Mali. But even though those have been kind of sucked into JNIM at this point, there was many of them from 2012, I think, to about 2017, before there was a consolidation. So what you see with these large groups, and you can see it in the Congo too, is that you'll often have like satellite groups around the large armed communities, and then they kind of get gobbled up. They get usurped by the larger groups if they are, so they can be kind of a local affiliate. So that's a sign, of course, that the larger groups are kind of overtaking the territory enough, whereby it's easier to ally with them than to contest even around them. But I think the bigger question, I'm curious about what you think of this, is what the end goal of these groups are.
Exactly. That's what I was going to ask, because that's the question I was going to come to look at them. If you look at how, so I'm working on a special issue as well on the side, looking at democracy and militarization in the Sahel. So one of my contribution is rethinking stabilization and how over the years stabilization, whereas in the past, look at in the maybe early post-Cold War, you see where political solutions were, you know, diplomatic solutions, but right, it's about stabilization and looking at how there's been less focus on finding diplomatic or lasting solutions to this, rather just you know, managing the situation. So to me, if you ask the question, like Riley said, it's about power.
Yeah.
To me, there's that power, and you know, there's the push for power. And like Riley said, I see less of ideology. I see less of, you know, want to establish Sharia, want to establish this. At the end of the day, the ultimate goal is always about power. But and then the fuel is whatever happens, maybe it's climate change, maybe it's marginalization or ethnicity and all of that issue. But I was going to ask, in relation to that, so we've seen the anti-Western narratives that the Kunta governments, you know, relied on in coming into power. And I've spoken to some, you know, we've had some from France and, you know, from the United States, and there's some level of acceptance that, yes, things could have been done differently, you know. This could have been done differently. So, but I'm saying, in the light of what's going on in the Sahel, what do you think could be, because it does look bleak, the future does look bleak if you look at the current situation. So what do you think is going to be a better approach to it from?
That's a really tough one. So because it's a kind of combination of all sorts of things. So it's, as I think we've seen in most contexts, IS does not want to have negotiations, you know, no matter where it is. And Al-Qaeda doesn't necessarily want to have negotiations, although they tend to be more embedded. You know, they will take on kind of a local governance focus because they embed and stay for a long time within the communities in which they operate. But I mean, I would bet that IS or JNIM has absolutely no intention of running these countries. They have no intention of establishing governments within these states so that they can be responsible for, you know, the education policy and everything else. I think that the situation in Afghanistan has also turned off jihadis to overtaking states because they're just a pain to run. But at the same time, they have to claim that they have a larger political and territorial motive that isn't we're contesting each other over these villages constantly and ongoing ways. And of course, like, we have to acknowledge that this violence is often quite lucrative in the sense that keeping it going allows them to tap into illicit markets that must be the reason that they can keep going. So they don't necessarily need a political goal anymore. They can simply say, well, we're going because this is effectively our job and we control these markets and all the rest of it. But one of the reasons that they have continued is not because there hasn't been a good diplomatic solution for it. It's that there hasn't been a great counter to them, you know, which is the reason that Wagner or Africa Corp ended up coming in the first place. I mean, they may be armed groups and they may want to generate a lot of violence. And in the places that they're generating the most violence, there may be weakened state institutions. But there's also just a very ineffective way of handling these threats. And that's not just from a military perspective, but it's also from a social perspective, which is that allowing these groups to infiltrate communities is the first problem. Because once they've infiltrated, you know, they can be like locusts. They don't need to emerge within a month. They can spend years just kind of, you know, tying people to their agendas. And a really good example of how this is playing out is if you compare northern Benin to what's happening within Togo. So JNIM has had a terrible time trying to infiltrate Togo. It's not that they've been totally unsuccessful. They've had some successes. But the reason that they've had such a difficult time is because the Togolese had a very strict system of intelligence gathering just at the very local level. So they don't leave anything to chance, you know? And in Mali, what you had were, of course, especially JNIM came about, what you had is huge areas in which the government was leaving a lot of new group formation to chance and not being particularly effective at stamping it out. And so as a long, this is a long-winded answer, but I suppose the reason that they're successful is because they haven't been stamped out yet. And they have kind of an economic motive to keep going. The reason that they're here is because they were able to infiltrate locally and grow from below, which makes them very difficult to stamp out. But where they're going is, I can just imagine, to continue. And again, as I said in the beginning, the contest between JNIM and ISGS is the main driver of this conflict. It's not between one of these states. It's not like they're desperate to run Burkina Faso. No, they're desperate to compete with each other. But I don't see any caliphate emerging by any stretch of the imagination. I just see them expanding the territory of their influence because they'll be able to reap the rewards of that as they keep going.
There's so many things that come up from there. But I'm glad you mentioned the expansion to the Dittoras states. And I think it's been a concern amongst Western partners in terms of how they're expanding to the coastal states. But you did mention something which I think You mentioned Togo and the resilience of the local communities in terms of, and then you compared that to either Mali. Does that also go to say that the, so we'll be looking in terms of like civil military kind of like relations and stuff like that. Why is Togo different?
Well, from what I understand, the intelligence gathering, even at the very local level in Togo, is much, much higher than the control that's exerted in, for example, northern Benin. And so new people or ideologies that were worrying or kind of discussions that might be considered anti-state were quickly responded to in Togo. In fact, I remember reading a great article, I think it was in the New Humanitarian, about northern Ghana and about how JNIM was trying to infiltrate northern Ghana. And it was a very similar story, which was that, you know, they started to kind of test the boundaries, test the boundaries of how much, how far in they could go and whether or not they could talk to local authorities and who was going to be against them and who was going to be for them and whether or not there were mosques or groups that they could try to infiltrate, like, you know, a typical way to move into new territory. And they were having a really difficult time in Ghana, according to this article, countering some of the radicalization rhetoric that they were hearing. And in fact, the Ghanaian government, I think, did launch a very, very successful at that time attempts to push them back and to open up the discussion within those northern communities to be aware of attempts to come in. And in Togo, which has far fewer, let's say, personal freedoms and democratic freedoms than some of these other countries, they simply stamped that out much quicker than they did so in Benin and Ghana. Although both in Benin and Ghana, there has been really, really serious attempts to make sure that there's no infiltration.
Very, it's very surprising. Like in the literature, you will see where, I think if I look at the Nigerian governments and if I look at the competition or the rivalry between the factions, between Boko Haram and ISWAP, and how that has helped, in my own opinion, the military, some of the military visits, but in JNIM and ISGS, I wonder why the governments in this way have not capitalized on that competition. So is it someone, because there's one of the contributors to the book volume was looking at how some of this group, you mentioned Benin and mentioned also, you know, that expansion, and that's why I asked you about potential competition and collaboration where it's necessary. If they, because they're very adept at being, you know, collaborating when they can.
Yeah.
But ordinarily, you think the competition between these two should provide an opportunity to really
right, like divide and conquer.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen it. If I was going to imagine the cooperation, it would be with JNIM before it was with ISGS. But again, I Henny would know this far better than I about the kind of internal politics within these groups and whether or not it would be feasible for somebody to ally or at least coordinate, I guess, with the government in order to drive out each other, right? And you're right. I think that it certainly seems like the most viable or at least a viable military option. I guess there's always unintended consequences to a decision like that prevent it from really taking hold, and so I would say that's probably one of the main reasons it might seem impossible. But I wanted to just bring up something that I think is important here, which is that, you know, in a lot of cases it's not the military who are taking on these groups, especially in their early stages. It's the police, you know. It's local police or it's community police or whomever. And so that's the real difference between understanding how feasible it is to stop this machine that's running through the Sahel. Because local police are not given a huge amount of tools to operate, you know? Mm. And so I would say that one of the solutions that I think is very important is to reinforce the police within, especially these states that are more likely to be infiltrated, because they're going to be your main line of defense.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And so this is some of the things that even in my PG, as far as that's one of the things that came out. And that ties into what you said before. And I think it was part of the, you know, narrative of the new conflict, where it's all about economics, it's all about criminality. And once it's turned to criminality, it's a police case. It's about increasing intelligence and increasing all of those stuff. But I wonder again why, and this is what I'm talking about, stabilization. Why, when we understand this, why do we prioritize counterterrorism? Why do we prioritize, you know, the military rather than investing in the police or the capability of the police? But can we also do that in the absence of addressing some of these drivers, some of these root causes of drivers?
Well, Michael, here we might deviate, because I don't believe that poverty or exclusion does drive conflict. Okay. I think it drives vulnerability to how conflict might affect a community. But, you know, conflict is a competition for power, and it's fought by the most powerful. Mm. And what you see, of course, is that a group might try to recruit from areas that are both marginalized and poor, because they might simply have a more compelling story for that recruitment than other opportunities available. And that makes perfect sense. But I think it's always very important to understand that the poor are not responsible for the conflicts that happen to them.
Yeah.
You know, they are simply the lowest kind of, like, the lowest cost option to operate within for a lot of groups. Mm. And conflicts emerge because very, very coordinated and often strong elite-backed organizations are willing to use violence for a political end, right? Mm. And they're willing to, of course, either use the lives of people who are often poor and marginalized to showcase how serious they are, or to recruit from, or sometimes both. And that's a very far cry from assuming that the violence itself is motivated by a desire to fix the situation for those communities, because it is not.
I agree with you, but I don't see much. I don't see much divergence in our views, because I see it as a condition that can be exploited rather than, so it's a condition, and I think it makes more sense to remove that condition if possible.
I mean, you're right about that, but I mean, one of the things that ACLED has recently found is that where we're seeing the greatest drives in conflict is in states with middle incomes and some democratization. And it's not necessarily states with high levels of polarization, and it's not necessarily situations in which, you know, you're trying to recruit a lot. But if you, it's an interesting comparison, because you brought up criminality to Mexico, for example. Mexican cartels are the number one employer in Mexico. You know, so this comes back to what we were saying about, well, who can make up your labor force, either for conflict or cartels? It's often the poor, you know, or the less advantaged. And they are taking advantage of a labor market. They're not subscribing to a political agenda, right? And I think sometimes the lens at which we decide to look at conflict, whether it's the fragility lens or the humanitarian lens, tends to emphasize, you know, grievance, poverty, marginalization, and then it forgets to emphasize military, police, you know, the competitive components that are leading to violence. And I think that's why we end up really focusing on welfare, which is very important, but it's a response to conflict, than the warfare that's going on, which is how to actually deal with it.
And I think that again also comes to that funny debate on security and development. Do we provide security and then get development? Or do we have to provide development and get security? And I think that we've not been able to reconcile that. So I don't know how we're going to do it. But if you look at some of the things in my own thinking, some of the things that, look at some of the things that these people exploit, these are valid. They are valid reasons, and then they exploit some of these things in the communities where they have these grievances and they're able to then... but I've also seen where... So in the case of Nigeria, where jihadist groups are trying to go to new territories in the Northwest, where you have more criminal groups, like the bandits and the militias. These are more very criminal. They're not. So there have been some level, but they've also not have success in this. So they've been able to water down the Islamic jihadist narrative. And that also kind of like validates your explanation about power. Power is the driving force for these cases. So what are we have always going to have this cycle of violence? How do we address this? So because I'm looking at the Sahel, I'm looking at it in terms of like the withdrawal, the Western partners, the US, the French are taking a back seat. We see Russia is not really doing great in these places. So what's going to be the solution? And this having also impact externally to the coastal states and also maybe to Europe and elsewhere as well. So what's going to be the eventual response to it?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think it's not development, right? That's why we've seen, in a time where we really supported development all around the world, we've seen a rise in violence. And so that formula is not working. The formula of security first, then development, as a way to, it could work, but not necessarily as a way to deal with conflict. Because as soon as we stop thinking of conflict as a failure of these systems and start thinking of it as a reoccurring feature, we will be able to figure out, well, all right, how much conflict should we expect if there's a contest between these entities, right? So what is the threshold through which this becomes violent? And how much violence is possible after that point? Because you can try to mitigate, let's say, the need for violence, but you'll never mitigate political competition. What we should be focused on is how can we make sure that political competition is non-violent? And that's an argument that we are losing.
I agree with you. And like you rightly said from the beginning, every conflict is local.
Yeah.
Every conflict is local. And but if we look at that, then also look at how we might have supported maybe democratization, maybe in Chad. You look at what France have done in Chad, or maybe Niger with former president. And but these have not necessarily created the conditions, the right conditions for the change to come. And definitely we've seen military rulers take over on these grounds, but they've also not presented, and I don't think any authoritarian government can present a better alternative to power. But looking at the kind of like your thinking, what is the best way forward? Because we've also seen ECOWAS have failed to establish itself as, you know, as one that can mediate in that sense. And then, like I said, we've seen French go back. So what is going to be, what I guess the question is, what is the future of the Sahel in 10 years from now?
Well, I think you'll either have far stronger governments because they've used all the military means at their availability to stamp out these conflicts. So, or you will see just an increasing continuous role like these conflicts have taken. So as I mentioned, there's really been a linear rise in the amount of violence that's happening. I think there's been incredibly ineffective ways to try to stop it. That, you know, one of the things that I often say about Mali is the reason it's not particularly taken seriously as a threat in Mali is because 76% of the population was totally unaffected by this conflict. It was someplace else, right? When conflicts are someplace else, even if they're within your own country, they are never going to be prioritized. But that is, they're kind of living on borrowed time in my expectations, because these groups are going to, when they deem themselves strong enough to enter into large cities, they will do that, just like Al-Shabaab did in other cases. And so if they're not destroyed now, right, it will get much worse. And there will be absolutely no assuming that we could recognize any state power within especially Mali and Burkina Faso in 10 years.
That sounds bleak, but I hope we're able to do that. So let me end on this note. So Akua is doing a very amazing job. I was looking at the scale of saying in quantitative sense. I think this. I was going to ask this earlier, but I kind of skipped it. In quantitative sense, what is the scale of the impact of the conflict on civilians? Because I've seen some figures like maybe first half of this year, we've seen nearly over 3,000 civilians killed.
Just in this last period, I think I have my notes right here and I'll be able to tell you. So this is Henny's new piece. So it should be of interest, I think, to anybody who's interested in some of these. So he says, in the first half of 2024, reported fatalities across the three Sahelian states reached a record high of 7,220, an increase of 9% compared to the same period in 2023, and 37% compared to 2022. So that's going in the wrong direction in pretty substantial ways. So we're talking about by the end of the year, we could reach 10,000, you know, and so 10,000 fatalities. And that's, of course, an undercount, as all fatalities tend to be. But one of the most important things is the number of people exposed, as in the number of people who have to live with this violence, is far higher than the number of people who die from it. And they're exposed again and again. What we see in Mali in particular is a very high number of assassinations of any local governance. So what Janem is trying to do, which is, you know, what happened in Sierra Leone and Liberia before, is to get rid of anybody who stands in their way. And that's going to be police officers and mayors and community leaders far more than it's going to be people in Bamako. So they're destroying the kind of institutional structures of these communities.
That is very sad. It does sound bleak to me if nothing is done. So hopefully we just retain that gleam of hope and hope something can be done. But let me conclude with this. What do you think? Do you think there's still room for a Western state government to intervene in this? Because you did mention the humanitarian side of things, and but I'm talking about in the light of all of this, because I think there's more focus on the coastal states.
I think that they are thinking, you know, how far can our resources go in Burkina Faso versus Benin, you know? I think that the resources that are needed in Burkina Faso are largely military resources. And that's not at all the same case as in Benin. But there's a role for them. I just don't know if it's appetizing for them to play that role just at the moment.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Thank you, Professor Raleigh, for your very, very rich insights. I'm grateful to you to have hosted you today. And then, thank you very much.
It's been an excellent chat. I really appreciate
it. Same here. You have a great day.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in today. Join me as usual to thank Professor Cleonard Raleigh for her very rich insight into the increasing jihadist attack in the Alliance of Sahel State. I encourage you to join me again next week for another interesting episode. For now, stay cool and stay blessed.